honorable members, we will now be receiving a briefing from CHE, Dr. Webstock, yes. And then CFO, Mr. Motusi, are you here? Yes. And then I know that I've got a council member, Professor Favor. All right, thank you very much. I think we're ready to start. I will now call upon Dr. Webstock to take us through the APP and the five-year structure.
Honorable Chair, if I may, hand over to a board member to just say a few words to start.
Okay, thank you. That's fine.
Chairperson, thank you, the Honourable Chair and the Honourable Deputy Minister and members, Honourable members. Firstly, to you, Chair, apologies from our Chairperson. Professor Masia underwent a rather extensive operation, and he's recuperating at home. And as you heard earlier, he's also the acting chair of the NSFAS and hopefully minister. It's not because of that he's doing two things that has put him under the weather. But sincere apologies from him, so I have stepped in at his request. There are four of us, not because of disrespect, Chairperson. Our colleagues from the NSFAS, they came in numbers maybe because of proximity, that we come afar, and there are only four, in part because I think we do need to respect the public purse, and we try and be prudent and frugal about the use of public resources. Chairperson, before I hand over to the acting CEO and the CFO, I thought I would just touch base on a couple of things just to provide context. I think the Chairperson, the Honourable Members and the Deputy Minister, you know the Council on Higher Education, but I think it might be useful just to refresh one or two issues to provide the context. We take the mission and the mandate of the Council on Higher Education principally from Education White Paper 3. I hope that is still familiar in people's minds. White Paper 3, the Program for the Transformation of the Higher Education System, is a 1997 white paper, which is still raising the issues that I think our country highlighted as the necessary transformation agenda for the higher education system. The Higher Education Act is our primary piece of legislation. Similarly, the National Qualifications Act, which is a more recent act that was promulgated. And at the heart of what we are supposed to do and what we believe we should be doing is to provide advice to the minister, either at request or proactive. And we've done that over the years. So some of the issues that we now see today are a consequence of some of the advice that were provided to the minister of education historically, at request, as I said, on a known initiative. We're here to promote quality and quality assurance in higher education, including auditing our institutions and accrediting learning programs. The relationship in terms of the white paper is that there is a link between planning, quality, and funding. So one of the links that we have managed to intertwine with the department is that the department, the state through the department, will not fund a university to offer a program or qualification unless it has been accredited. Similarly, with the privacy and issues that you raised, Chairperson, that private institution will not be registered, the program will not be registered unless it has been accredited. So there is that relationship that has been built over time. We also monitor the state of higher education and public information regarding the developments of higher education on a regular basis, and I'll come back to that one, Chairperson. And I'm just picking on some of those issues, and develop and manage the qualification sub-framework for higher education, and in this regard, we are responsible in terms of the NQS Act for the higher education sub-framework. That's the sub-framework that defines the qualifications that all higher education institutions may offer. Currently, it runs from level 5 to 10, starting with the higher certificate qualification type all the way through to doctoral degrees. Chairperson, just as we reflect with your permission and the permission of the honorable members on our strategic plan to 2020, our APP for the current fiscal year, as well as the MTF as well, and the budget for the current fiscal year, it might be useful also to reflect on the issues that we were discussing with you in the last period. We were here last, late last year. And some of the issues that we raised, which we felt we were trying to begin to address, hopefully positively in your eyes, the challenges that we had identified in the 2012-2017 strategic plan include, but not necessarily the exhaustive, the fact that we released in 2013 a report on the proposal for undergraduate curriculum reform in South Africa. And this is what we titled the case for flexible curriculum structure. We believe, Chairperson, that that was a contribution of the Council, a major contribution to finding solutions to one of the most intractable challenges that is facing the higher education sector. There are many. And one of them are the issues that we were discussing around the financial aid and access to financial support. But this one is about what I think collectively, including this House, believes is the poor throughput and graduation rate in graduation. It's one thing to provide opportunity for people to come in, but if they don't go out, they won't be able to pay the NS bus. If they don't go out, you won't be able to get the accountants or the engineers and so forth. So the necessity of providing opportunity must go hand in glove with increased success and throughput. We also, in February of last year, released the framework for institutional quality enhancement in the second period of quality assurance. As I said earlier, it's part of our responsibility. The aim of the QDP, again, is to contribute to enhancing teaching and learning, particularly with a focus to improving success. And consequentially, if you have improved success, the likelihood of getting graduate throughput also increases. If you don't pass, you will not graduate. It's as simple as that. And we believe that part of what we try and do is to choose the things that matter in order to find creative ways of improving the performance of the system, and that's part and parcel of the transformation agenda. We concluded, Chairperson, late last year, the 20-year review of the higher education system, which in many ways reflected on where we have come from since 1994, mindful that the white paper only came on board in 1997, likewise the Act in the same sort of timeline. However, we chose 1994 because that is the dawn of our democracy, and we do need to reflect on how well we are performing. We are anticipating, Chairperson, having that report out in the next period, but clearly before the first half of this year. At the pleasure of the committee, we would be happy to come and share that report and talk to the issues that it raises, both in terms of how well we have succeeded, what the issues we believe are necessary for us to continue to deal with as we go forward into the next 10 or 20 years, mindful of the expectations of the National Development Plan. Lastly, Chairperson, we have been doing quite a bit of work around the development of qualification standards, and which are necessary for the reaccreditation at a national level of qualifications that we deem important in the in the national higher education system. You will recall, right early in the early days of the Council of Higher Education, we went and did a national review of the MBAs. And as a consequence of that national review, certain MBAs suddenly ceased. And I think that's where the issue, as honorable members were asking, whether the council has teeth or not. It does still have teeth, but the teeth are used responsibly. Some of those MBAs ceased. We went through, I'm just using an example, the Bachelor of Education. Now, universities are responsible for the production of teachers, so it's imperative that the quality of those graduates is of is very high. Otherwise, I think it has a cascading impact on the rest of the education system. We recently completed the National Review of the Bachelor of Social Work, and we are in the process of developing the qualification standards for the Bachelor of Law degree. You've heard the issues that are in the legal profession about whether or not the LLB is doing the work that it's supposed to do, and so that's part of the reasons why we've embarked on that. There are many other areas, Chairperson, but when we present to you the strat plan, the APP, and the MTF, we will do our best also to respond to the issues that you highlighted earlier, the challenge of the filling of vacancies. It is with regret that I wish to inform you, Chairperson, that we also unfortunately lost our CEO earlier this year. As a council, we have embarked on a methodical, deliberate process to fill that position. It is one of the most important things that a board can ever do. If you get it wrong, I think you have the right to flop us. If we get it right, we can really do something very valuable. So that process hopefully will get underway maybe by the time we meet next time, Chairperson, but we shall see. Similarly, the issue of the offering of accredited programs by private higher education institutions, and we've been working with the department, and we'll talk a little bit with them. If it pleases the House, Chairperson, I will now hand over to the acting CEO and the CFO to take us through the presentation.
Thank you very much. Over to you, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Chair and honourable members. I have some of similar things at the beginning of my presentation, but I'll emphasize very different things, I think. We've talked about the mission and vision and who we are and what we do. It's very simple, that monitoring research, monitoring trends in higher education, and what we do, we try to have a medium to long-term vision. So the kinds of things that we get involved in are looking at our board member called intractable problems, trying to get people together to think about those and think about a way through. The one he talked about already is the one about poor throughput, and in that particular research there are so many other bits that are really important. For example, the economic modeling that we did of the way subsidy is used and not used in terms of throughput, what effect it has in terms of mismatch, and what would be a better scenario to actually do to get a throughput up that is both educationally sound and economically feasible. So it's those kinds of things that we're looking at, and I'll talk about that again in relation to some other projects that are coming up. Of course, there is also the more executive function, which is carrying out the quality assurance, and I'll talk more about our shift from audits to quality enhancement in relation to that. And as he pointed out also, the managing of our sub-framework, which is the higher education sub-framework. In terms of context, I think it's important to know that we're actually a very small organization. If we think about directorates that manage, let's say, for example, accreditation of our business, it's 11 people that manages the accreditation of all the programs in public and private higher. We have our audits directorate is, I think, 6, our monitoring and evaluation is 6, Our newly merged director that drives the national reviews and standards is 5 people. So we're actually quite small and quite lean. And that means that we also work with a lot of academics and peers in the system, because we think that this, we need to work in a consultative kind of way. And so we use a lot of stakeholders and peers to augment what we do, but not in the sense of consultants that we've been hearing about. These are people who volunteer their services, and if they're lucky, we give them lunch. But they do count as consultants when we give them honoraria sometimes, and so that also needs to be taken into account in the way that we work. 5 years ago, when that previous strategic plan was put together, I think that we were in a different place, in the sense that some of our directors were not functioning optimally and that they weren't fully staffed. You will see, we talked about the MBA, and now then it was teacher ed, and then it was social work, but in between, the directorate became almost defunct. If you lose 3 people out of it, it's kind of gone for a while. I'm very happy to report that all of our directorates now are fully functional, fully staffed. We have 1 vacancy as a result of a dismissal in a CCMA case, which we should hear about the results of in the next week. And we fill vacancies as they come up. So we're in a very different case. We have also, over the last 5 years, spent a lot of time, and maybe a little bit of that later towards the end of the presentation, on kind of growing up as an organization in terms of our policies and our procedures and the way we do performance management and the way we have wellness programs and all of those things. There's been an enormous amount of effort put into that, very successfully. So it's kind of come from the garage band to being something of an orchestra now. It's a very different kind of space. Our board member mentioned the undergraduate curriculum reform project, which is one of those that we have recently completed and given advice to the minister on. We also have this is just recapping very quickly what's happened in the last while, the quality enhancement project. You will know that for 10 years we undertook institutional audits. The function has not gone away. We still have 4 institutions whose audits are open because we are needing to work with them to try to get their improvement plans to the level that we are really wanting them to be able to progress within. But we are having an interregnum of 5 years in which we thought what we learned in that audit cycle was that teaching and learning needed much more hands-on work in terms of quality. And that's what the Quality Enhancement Project is all about. It's work with institutions now in specific areas to try to improve those. We have some baseline information from them now in those areas so that we know what they're doing. They can also learn from each other. And then in the second phase of the 5 years, and in fact I think it's quite soon, probably September, the second submission are ones where we will look at institution by institution. Because we have said, now you've learned, you've given us your baseline information, what have you done in that area to improve, and learn from others where you can improve in those particular areas. So that's what the Quality Enhancement Project is about, and then in the second 2 years of that, we will have 4 different areas that we focus on, and those will most likely be curriculum, because it would fit in with the undergraduate curriculum reform, and some other related areas. We've talked about the review of the state of higher education. There are quite some intractable problems coming out of that that are now informing our thinking about what our next projects would be. I have to say that in those last time in managing our sub-framework, we have revised, as you would know, the whole ATQSF. We have also taken on the mammoth task of aligning all the programs in higher education with that framework, and have been through 10,500 programs. So all of the existing ones are now aligned. There are, however, about 3,000 or so that are being taught out, and as new programs come in, they are going through the full accreditation process as program by program, except where we are getting, let's say, a cluster of education ones. We might do those together so that we can save on evaluators' time and effort. So that's been a mammoth one, and I'm very pleased to say we planned it as a project. We wanted to take our role as managing the subframework really seriously, and we have done that. We talked about the qualification standards. There are five that are now complete. LLB is one of them. There are two in engineering, a social work one that emerged from the review, and we can now take that one further. So I think that that's very useful, and that we've now merged that with national reviews and seen them as processes that are integrated is, I think, a really good move. We've talked about the Bachelor of Social Work review. We have the last of the improvement plans coming in at the moment. And then I think we have also revived the quality promotion work. That was also another one that seemed to have died along the way. But we now have, within the CEO's office, we have a director and a manager who are coordinating all of the promotion work, which was the kind of activities like quality assurance forums and conferences and so on, and policy related work. A few more context factors, and I'll be very quick with this. I really think that it's been since 2004 that we've really taken on the quality assurance function in earnest. But I'm just going to pick out one or two there, because I've talked about some of this. I think one of the changes that we are confronted with is that in the last 10 years, we have concentrated really hard on the higher education sector and unification of the higher education sector. Now the landscape has shifted to a post-school sector. So whereas our work on the qualifications framework focused very much on let's get it making sense within higher education, we're now looking at the borders. How do we look at articulation between the sectors? So it's changed. I also think an important context factor is we have a tight fiscal climate. We have a 7% cut in the budget this year, 10% next year. At the moment it's fine, we can manage, but at a certain point it will impact on the projects that we can undertake, and it will start to skew the staff compensation versus goods and services budget. That will happen. So it's something that you have to bear in mind and manage for the future. Then, in terms of our strategic plan going forward, it's very simple. We have four main imperatives. The one is to enhance our policy analysis and information function. Get out there more, do more policy work, know what's going on, do far more of the research of the kind that I was talking about earlier. That's the one. The other is obviously to manage the higher education qualification sub-framework and the standards. That's more or less an ongoing function, to develop the quality assurance system further, and then as an organization to build our intellectual capability. I think that's really very important, and an enabling an organizational climate, and we've come a very long way with that last one. In terms of the first, one of our functions is to provide advice to the minister on his request and also proactively. We have a particular one that we have been working on that should be coming to fruition soon, and that's about the enduring governance challenges that we have in some of our institutions in higher education. So we've done a lot of background research on that, and that will translate into some advice about how do we deal with these ongoing challenges at a broader level. These are not immediate solutions. As I said, these are medium to long-term kinds of solutions, and advice arising from the review. In terms of monitoring states of higher education, our focus is on completing existing projects. We have one on student governance at the moment. We have a book coming out shortly, which is a rather nice to have rather than essential, but it is a very nice to have. And that's a book of reflections of retired vice chancellors on what they learned from leadership and what they would pass on to a new generation of vice chancellors. So we have 9 contributions in that, and it's in the final stage of being edited. We have some ongoing projects. You will have seen, Chair, I think we sent you the latest vital stats, which we keep expanding, and website data. We had a background one on placement mechanisms in higher education, and by that we meant once your students are admitted to higher education, how do you decide which curriculum they do? It's not an area that we are very advanced in South Africa. So that is one of the things that we've been looking at. But whether we continue with that really depends very much on the response of us on the flexible curriculum. So clearly, if that's something that you do, you need to be able to say very clearly how you would choose some students to take one curriculum and not another, for 4 years opposed to 2 years. Then these are not very well formed, but these are projects in gestation, if you like. We think it's really, and we've just heard it some more, a really critical problem in higher education is student funding, not just student financial aid, but the whole problematic of student funding. And again, there we want to take a medium to long-term view, see what the century can do about, what are the best models, what would be the implications if we funded students to go to private institutions, what would, where is extra funding? I mean, there's some of the questions that Ms. Fass was asking. Who can do this kind of work? We can do the cohort analyses and find out what is happening to those who have Ms. Fass funding, for example. As a start, we can find out where are the other possibilities for funding, both government, private, etc., but also from institutions themselves. Many institutions also fund their students. We don't have a whole picture. So that's something that we would like to do, obviously in consultation with the relevant bodies. It's not an evaluation of Ms. Fass that's been done. It's not that at all. It's looking at what are the possible scenarios and how can we think through the student funding problem. Again, academic staffing is one that comes through from our review project. We know the numbers. We've looked at, for example, over the last 20 years, we have increased student numbers by 80%. Our permanent academic staffing complements are only 35. And our temporary staffing has grown enormously. Now, we look at that and we see, okay, well, what informs that? And there is, apart from some that our other board member has done, there's very little qualitative research on the academic profession. What informs it? What makes it either sexy or non-sexy for new people to enter? Why do some PhDs choose it and others don't? What is it about the capacity in the system? Can the system actually continue to grow at the same rate on the same trajectory? Is that possible? So again, looking at various scenarios. So that's another one we have on our horizon. And the other is about the use of ICTs in higher education. We started with a colloquium on that, but from a much more policy perspective rather than how do you use this in the classroom. So looking at some of the intellectual property issues, a lot of the policy-related issues to that, and how is it, could we use, here's one of the big questions I was talking about, how could we possibly use ICTs almost for some institutions to leapfrog what we think is a normal development trajectory? Is it possible? Could we do that? Could we use ICTs for enhancing the quality of our curriculum? If we used, I'm getting excited here. If we use so-called rat MOOCs, you know, we know the whole problematic of MOOCs and they're all very difficult, but there's good curriculum out there. How is it that we can use it and adapt it in our context to enhance the quality of our education? I mean, Physics 1 is Physics 1 pretty much anyway. So how do we make the best use of it?
But I request that we focus on the presentation so that we allow members enough time for engagement.
I'll get back.
Thank you.
All right. We've talked about managing the HEQSF and the standards. I'm not going to say very much more there, except the manifestation of how we're looking at the boundaries of the sub-framework is also one of the things we're trying to kind of clear up. It's a very cluttered terrain of external quality assurance bodies. And I know institutions are worried about that all the time. There are all sorts of bodies coming in to do accreditation. So we're working with them on a framework to try and simplify it all. I've talked to some extent about the standards. I don't need to repeat that. This is another one. A function that we have in law is to collect data on students, so student records that go through to the NLRD. And we do that via a system, and this is for private to go through HEMA, that's not such a problem. But in private higher, we have a system called the Higher Education Quality Committee Information System, and that we are trying to extend to have as much information in it as HEMA does about the private sector, because we know that's been a notoriously bad area to try and get information on. We have managed to get all, I think, 98% of the institutions to submit their data. The data is, however, of varying quality, so we're looking now, we're working with the department on how we can audit that data better and make sure that we get really good data out of it. In terms of quality assurance, as I mentioned, we are already changing to the Quality Enhancement Project. There's some detail about it there and the areas that are being focused on. And I don't, as I said, we're not abandoning the audit function, but this is an interregnum. And it might also be possible for us to audit specific parts of the higher education institutions, for example, governance, which might be one of the things coming out of the advice on governance. Our accreditation function, I talked about the HSUSF, but we also have a very big routine accreditation function. We get in maybe 400 new programs a year, and we are increasing the number of site visits so that we can actually augment the, and it's not a paper-based system, it's an electronic system, but we can augment the information that's submitted with actual visits by peers to institutions. We have done that, but we're just simply increasing that. I've talked about the Bachelor of Social Work. We are now initiating a review on the LLB. The standard has been developed by the practitioners and the deans and so on. And so now they can go and look at each other, in a sense, and make sure that those standards are being reached or find ways to reach them. I've talked also a little bit in anticipation, talking about the quality promotion function. We do an awful lot of training. Again, this looks like consultants sometimes and inflates our lunch bill because we train a lot of people, maybe 50 at a time, and we now have a group going around the country training more evaluators. We asked for peer evaluators. I think we've got 450 applications in response. So we decided to train them. And then lastly, I talked about the fourth area, which is, and I spoke a lot about it at the beginning, so I won't repeat that, about the enabling organizational climate and getting our posts filled. And there I think I'm going to leave it. Chair, I did speed up a lot. There I'm going to leave it and hand over to our CFO to take you through some of the numbers.
Would you like to elaborate a bit on the articulation?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I don't know that articulation within higher education is as much of a problem as we sometimes think, because we have designed the HEQSF such that it has many different pathways, articulation pathways. All of the qualifications relate to each other in particular ways. That's what I was saying. We focus very much within higher ed. But it's now at the borders of that with the FETs and schools. And articulation there, we obviously the proposal on the four-year curriculum is looking at that level of articulation. But it's more this growth of the FETs, and I think that needs to be done and managed in relationships between institutions at that level. It's hard to do that, regulate that from the centre, but that's certainly an area of effort that we are looking at.
I will then call upon the CFO to take us through the numbers. I'm told numbers do not lie.
Thank you, Chair. Quick one on the financials. Just to highlight that we experiencing, or we, the Department of Higher Education, together with National Treasury, did cut our original budget allocation for 2015-16 by 7%, and 2016-17 by 10%. for 2017-18, no cut has been implemented. And in total, for 2015-16, we have 40.8, for 2016, 40.9, and for 2017-18, 47.9. The impact in respect of the cut obviously says that as management, we need to reprioritize and to look at all other factors in terms of how can we implement what we have said in the APP against the allocated budget. As management, we did engage and look at this and presented to council in terms of how are we going to go about implementing the project as set out in the APP. Obviously, members of this committee, there are some projects that are going to be cut, but taking into account that our budget is mostly informed by projects. And in a project budget system, the most contributing spending items is mostly on traveling and also on accommodation and other factors, based on the fact that we are using tests, we are using evaluators to come and do some to do some contribution into our system. So that's basically the impact. But we'll closely monitor the spending trends quarterly, as we have been doing, to see if we are still within the budget, with the hope that we anticipate a rollover of funds for this current financial year after we have completed and submitted the financials in May 2015. And then that allocation or the rollover will inform us in terms of how do we allocate to the pressing needs or pressing priorities that are not fully funded because of the budget allocation. In terms of sourcing of source of income for the MTF period, this is how it's done. Just to highlight to the members to understand that the transfer that we get from the Department of Higher Education is that 40. In addition to that, we have other incomes that come through, which is mostly from cost recovery in terms of private accreditation. That's when the institution submits programs for accreditation, and there's a tariff or a charge that we normally charge these institutions. And we are estimating the income about that amount of 4 million. And also there's this other income, which is mostly from what is available in our web bank in terms of interest and rental income, which is 850. Together, it amounted to 47.8 for 2015-16, for 2016-17, 46.2, for 2017-18 is 52.7. And this is how we have allocated the allocation of the budget for economic classification. And this is how it has been allocated for the entire three-year period, which is the MTF period. Just to highlight to members, for them to note that our composition of employees, when you look at it honestly, is higher than the goods and services. And I think I want to highlight the reason why. It is basically because of what transpired on the prior years, where the allocation of the budget was cut. And I think members need to understand that when you have warm bodies, which is the employees already being the system paid at a certain level, there's no way that you can cut the salary of that individual. So we have to pay the officials because we are obliged to pay the officials as per the agreement with the employees. And another factor to that is that there's an increasing amount of personnel on an annual basis. Cost of living also plays a role here. So we cannot be in a position to cut the personnel cost. The only area which we can mostly focus in terms of cutting is on goods and services. And this is very hard for us, but we are trying to make sure that the priorities are really allocated to the funds to make sure that we achieve our mission and objectives. So in terms of payments of capital assets, as indicated there, we have buildings, machinery, and software. Just to indicate to the members that the office accommodation where we are housed in is our own office accommodation. We are not renting it, but there's a need for us to maintain and do certain things in terms of the building. But we are not renting it out. We are just occupying it as our own building. for the allocation per program, just to indicate to the members that we have about 5 programs in our institution, as listed there, and just to indicate that members must know that on item number 5, national reviews and farmer development has been meshed. It was 2 different programs, and management together with council didn't fit that these 2 programs need to be meshed as one, and now the numbers have reduced from 6 to 5. So this is the allocation per program, and the main reason why some of the programs are higher than the others, basically because this is a combination of goods and services together with personnel, and I think basically on administration the contributing factor there is about maintenance, which is mostly on facilities issues and also on ICT related, because all these things are centralized at administration. From the goods and for compensation of employees, administration has more numbers in terms of the income. We had about 16 compared to the other program. And I think that's the reason why this the figure is higher than other programs. Another administration, just to highlight to the members, is inclusive of the CEO's office and support services. Support services is the office of the CFO and corporate services. And under corporate services, we have facilities, we have ICT, we have HR. So that's the reason why the allocation looks higher than compared to others. Under monitoring institution and accreditation and national revenue, mostly of the allocation is based on the project as per the APP in terms of what we want to achieve. And we try as management to allocate as per the submitted budget from the program to make sure that they achieve their intended objectives. And others are higher. For example, like accreditation is one of the programs that is having more employees compared to the other programs. And I think that's the main reason why there's discrepancy in terms of the allocation. But the allocation is done fairly so, because the process in terms of the allocation of the budget is three. We request the program, different programs, to submit their budget. It's discussed at the senior management meeting. And after the approval from the senior management team, it's presented now to the audit and risk committee to look at it and okay it and recommend to council for approval. And all this process has been followed, hence the submission and a final approval from Department of Higher Education and National Treasury. I think that's all from my side, Chair. I'll wait for questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the
presentation.
Now we'll move on to the point. I will now open the session for hate discussion. Honorable Member Tekana, then Honorable Member Professor Kubisa, and Honorable Member Suela. Honorable Member Professor Pozoli.
Accreditation and quality are very important. But you know, often when we discuss them, we're discussing them. Personally, what I like to see is to see us discussing them and they're on the ground, seeing that the standard that we are setting and the quality that we're saying is of high standard, proving itself out there in practice on the ground, as we should compete, create jobs against the whole world, including all industries. I'm saying this because, look, when we started, the economic policy was clear: growth, employment, and redistribution. And people complain that if there's no job creation, employment, there's no redistribution, people are unemployed. And around 2006 and 2007, they are about after 10 years, taking to 1996 as the beginning. Then they reviewed that policy. And as Giza and Gipsa came and they said, we don't have engineers. That's why the economy is not growing as fast. We're producing 500 engineers a year instead of 1,000. And they also said infrastructure, road, rail, all kind of things, and the World Cup assisted, because with harbors, sea and air ports, that assisted them, roads and all that. Now, the point is this. When you do accreditation and you raise standards, we're not able to know. I know you said you'll give the full report later. We'd like to know how many engineers, because they said those are the scarce skills. And we could see it in local government, because they couldn't build further townships, provide housing, because they were running short of civil engineers. Now, we'd like to hear you respond to the economic review of our policy, as Gisa and Jim said, that said we don't have engineers, and tell us whether we're producing those engineers. And if they are of high standard or good quality, we'd like to see them. I mean, industrial revolution, I like to say, in Europe, when it took place, you could hear in Scotland, this one discovering this. Why in our engineering field we don't hear people discovering, like Japan did, cheaper ways of producing cars that consume low petrol because of the OPEX increase of petrol? I mean, all industries, when the car industry started, petrol energy was in abundance. But Japan later realized the only way to beat them in this industry is to produce Mazda and Toyota that consumes low, that is a low consumption of petrol. Now, our engineers, in fact, in medicine, at least we're hearing this, given what happened in Stellenbosch. But in the real commercial industry, where we say raw material must be beneficiated, we don't see our engineering entering that chain value, that value chain, and adding value and discovering new things of doing new industry to compete with the world. And now, if you keep on saying accreditation qualities are good and the like, but you don't see it on the ground and people are still unemployed. The issue of, just the last point, the issue of the rural areas, where there was a suggestion that there's a way of producing toilets that sucks rather than use water, and after sucking they destroy the disposal immediately, only kind of ash come at the end. That type of engineering, why is it not improved so that the public consumption can use it? I'm just saying, I mean, it doesn't really help to hear about good quality if you don't see it on the ground, if we are still unemployed, if our raw material is still beneficiated overseas. Where is the engineering capacity that we're producing? I mean, if it is there, then it will attract investment. Because if somebody says this is a better car, then people will invest in it. But it is just quiet.
Well, I remember, thanks. I think you've made your point. Thank you very much. Next.
Thank you, Chair. I think mine is somehow related to this one, because one of your objectives is to develop a database which you later submit to the National Learner Records Database. I'm interested in this kind of objective tallied with the NDP, not just an accumulation of scores for submission, but also related to employment opportunities in our country. So we have scores, not just mathematical scores, but to see how students have performed. We're excited about this, but we want to know how this impacts work opportunities, employment opportunities, and also what the Honorable Deputy Minister referred to, how this stimulates economic growth generally in country should be driving to. Education is of no value until it manifests itself in practice. Here is a person who has graduated. What is it that the person is doing? Rather than saying, you got an MBA, you got 85% in it, and we've got your records. But at the end of the day, what does it do? What does it do to the country? Does it somehow elevate the standard of the economy of the country? So that's what I'm interested in. I'm sure this is related to what the Honorable Fekan referred to, the production of master, tutor, whatever, elevating the standard of the economy of the country. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. The next speaker, please let's be short and to the point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I wanted also to speak on the issue of accreditation that the Council on Higher Education does. Many times you hear complaints about the product that comes out of the university. In particular, let me talk about teaching. You hear principals complaining that these teachers that come from universities cannot do this or cannot do that, or they are not ready to teach and so on, yet you are embarking on a very important work of accrediting these courses. Do you really have an idea of how these universities are actually training these educators so that they fit into the environment where they are going to teach at the end of, at the completion of their courses? Because that will have an effect on the output that comes out of the basic education, because we have got these low pass rates. Of course, many of the students that are passing definitely do not qualify to get back into universities per se, because they couldn't perform much better. Yet they are being taught by these teachers who come from these fancy institutions that are being accredited by your good self. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I also wanted to ask something on teacher education. I think you've done two reviews of teacher education over the past years, but we hear from somebody like Nick Taylor, who's working for the Department of Basic Education, that teacher education is in a shocking state. Now, what is the role of the CHE in doing something about that? Because you're meant to be there as the people who look at standards, who advise the minister about standards. What is your view of the standards of South African higher education? We don't appear in world rankings particularly. We have people complaining that our graduates can't even read or write properly. Many professions we have complaints to, lawyers, not only teachers, we hear lawyers who don't know the law, teachers who are semi-literate. What are you doing to help the minister decide how to fix this? Because at the moment, the way you present yourself, it seems as if you've actually regressed from being quite a vigorous organization that pushed standards in higher education to an organization that does a lot of work, the writing papers and documents, but actually doesn't do as much of that as you used to. Now, when it comes to your quality enhancement, which in my view doesn't substitute at all for the audits of universities, is that quality enhancement done through a system of international benchmarking, or is it just, you know, they're now at level 3, we're going to bring them up to level 4, and in about 8 years' time we'll have them up to level 10? In other words, an incremental approach, or do you actually have a benchmark-driven approach saying this is what we want this qualification to look like, and this is how you're going to get there, or this is what you must do to get there? Can we, and then your review of the sector, I'm very interested to hear that that's nearly complete. Please, if you come and present to the committee, which I think would be an excellent idea, could we have a review, copy of that review well in advance, because I'm sure it's quite substantial, and also could you bring along with you, in spite of the cost, a broader range of people so that we can see some of the contributors to the review. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Bozoli. I will now move on to Ms. Killian.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you. I was partially covered. Just two more issues. The one is, I think I wanted to have clarity about the outcomes of our education system, as you're going to implement that through the learner tracking system, whatever you call it. But the issue is, to what extent would you give advice, or are you waiting for the minister to ask you for such advice, towards directing NSFAS funding more towards scarce skills as identified in the NDP? So that's just the one issue. The second issue is, there's just slight calculation error, I think, Jay. If the report is correct, this annual strategic plan and performance plan, etc., on schedule three, the table three, I have just noticed, because I was just, you know, looking at the presentation. If we look at the presentation, and it is the double-sided this print version, it's page four, it means it should be slide 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I just note that there's a R1 million that was added in comparison to what the table says. It says here 47 million, and here it says 846 in your document. And I think the calculation is just the collapsing of the two programs. There was a little calculation error, not a major thing. As long as this document is correct, which is important for the records of Parliament, that is fine. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I take it that the CHD is a regulator, and I'm sure the Council is aware that the perception out there on our education is not very good. The people out there, they usually compare the now and the old, and they seem to be saying the old is better than the now. But then, if we had, if we have the old, if it was doing something better, then it means we have retired people who have got a vast experience. Has the council ever tried to make use of this vast experience which we are losing? I understand in Japan how Japan, why Japan is doing what it's doing. It does not lose experience. People who have experience are help to mentor the new ones so that there is production and visible production. Thank you.
Thank you,
Thank you, Chair. Just one question. I'd like to know what is happening to those qualifications such as your BTEC, which are not in line with the HEQSF, but still offered by the university. Is there a phase-out program? If so, are the institutions and students aware of the phase-out plan? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I will now hand over to the CEO to lead us with the responses from CHE.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members, for those questions. Some of them are very complex. In response to the first one about the production of engineers, there's a whole complex of issues involved here. And the one way of looking at it is there's a graph in our study on throughput rates. And if you look at the numbers that have been pushed into engineering over the last 20 years, we're not getting the same out. The lines are actually frightening. So you see that even though we have more students, we're not getting more graduates. That's very frustrating. That's the first thing. At the same time, you have to balance that with an overall graduate unemployment rate, which is very low, which is about 5%. We also have professional engineers who are working as technologists. So I have to say that our Honourable Deputy Minister is exactly right when he says that in order to get the economy going, we have to build the TVET sector. We need those technologists. They're not there. And it doesn't make sense to have professional engineers doing those jobs. So there's a whole range of things that one has to look at to do that. I don't know that accreditation in and of itself will do that. The responsibility for quality is that of the institution. All we can do is say, here are a number of criteria that you need to fulfill in order to be able to offer this program. And those are minimum criteria. So what happens after that, whether the program is really good or whatever, is a different process. That's either done by the professional body, in this case an ECSA, with whom we work very closely with, or it's done through the national review that we've been talking about, where you go and look at the teacher education, you go and look at the social working, and say, yeah, we accredited this thing, it needs, you've got the right teachers and so on, but you're not producing social workers that we think are appropriate for the needs that we have in this country because they're lacking in these skills or whatever. That's what the national review does. So I'm going to skip now to the one about teacher education and come back to some of the others. So I think you're right that we have had a harder edge in the past. You will remember the BS and the teacher ed. Where we found it on the teacher education, and I'm being completely honest here, it really is quite political, because how do you shut down some of those programs when there are thousands of students in them and it's a flagship program of a particular institution? So you have to find a way to try and make it better. It's much easier in an MBA space where you've got a few privates to say, well, we're not going to let you offer. But you can't do that when you're actually relying on those teachers. So that's why the quality enhancement thing comes in. We have to live with those and we have to try and make them better. So again, in the social work, for example, they're saying those ones are notice of withdrawal of accreditation. Just know that. But we want to see, first of all, you have to have an opportunity to fix that. So first of all, you want a proper plan. What are you going to do to fix it? Then we monitor it. Then we say, okay, now that you have your plan, we need a progress report so many months hence to see how have you fulfilled that plan. So don't just give us a plan, you actually have to do something. So that's where a lot of the hands-on work is coming in. Also with the audits that are still open, where you get plans from institutions at an institutional level that don't have any evidence or they don't really have a plan or they're just numbers. And then you actually have to go and work with them and say, no, we want something real. That is actually going to show us how you are going to fix those things. So that's really hands-on on work there. Then the question about the NLRD and the data and the employment opportunities, again, I think that relates to the need to develop the whole TVET sector, which I think is exactly where we need to go. And that's where I talk about articulation as well. We need to make sure that sector has a purpose in its own right, but also does not close off doors for students who want to go into formal higher education. So I think that's really very important. And then about accreditation, I already said accreditation is really a licensing. You look at, these are the criteria, do you have the people, have you got a program that's structured in a sensible kind of way? Yeah, we will see that there are complaints about some programs, and that's when we do, certainly, and mostly it has been so far in the private sector, but now we're going into the public, that's where we're going to the site visit, where we get the complaints about what's happening with that program. We have the right to go and have a look, and we have a reaccreditation process there. But sometimes we do it just because it's emerging from the sector that we need to have a look at LLBs across the sector. That's when you do a national review. So there's various processes that we have to look at those particular problems. I'm coming back to teacher education because I see that there. Yes, we've also spoken with Nick Taylor and seen his research on what's happening in teacher education. And it is dire. So again, one would have to marry that with the enhancement problem with also what does one do about it? Can you actually, you know, we sit with really hard decisions. You see a program at a particular institution and you say, we really ought to close that down. But what does that mean for all of those students? How do we do that? Those are very difficult questions. The quality enhancement, the shift to quality enhancement and the benchmarking, what we're doing in that particular space is actually looking, as I said, at very focused areas and getting groups of institutions to benchmark against each other in those particular processes. We've also worked very closely with the Scottish system because they have an enhancement-based system. So we have got on board all the DVCs as co-leaders of that project, in a sense, so that they're involved in it. And they will, I think, in September, October, all be going to have a look at how the Scottish institutions are dealing with those very same issues, those DVCs, as a group. So that's the kind of thing that we do in the enhancement program. What was the review of the sector? Oh, the BTEC. Yes, the BTECs are having to be thought out. I have a communique on my desk at the moment to send out to the BTEC. We have negotiated with the department and with SACWA a final date for taking in students into a BTEC, which will be December 9th, 2017, which means that there will be students in BTECs as long as it takes them to in the pipeline, to get out the pipeline. But that's part of all of, it's really hard work for the universities of technology because they're having to redesign pretty much all of their programs. And so there's some, those 3,000 that I was talking about that are being replaced, they are busy redesigning the new ones so that they will be ready to take students into when the BTEC, et cetera, is phased out. And of course we are between two systems. So we also have to make plans for, let's say, students who have an MTech and who would have expected to go on to a doctoral program. It's not the same in the new system, but we're making the plans from the old system to the new. Okay, and then, retired. Have I got there yet? No, I'm getting there. There's still another one. Can't read my writing. I'll come back to that now. The retired people. It's an interesting one that you say that. We looked in the graphs of temporary staffing in higher education, and the growth in those above 60 is phenomenal. So I guess that higher education institutions are superannuating and using them. We also do, wherever possible, I've told you about the book that we're talking about, but we also do try to pull on that expertise, and that's why I'm trying to find ways to communicate that. And that book is one of them. BTEC, and then outcomes. It was Honourable Member Killian's question. Oh, the Table 3, okay. Yeah. I think I dealt with it. Thank you, Chair. I think if I've left anything out, please, or just let me know.
Honourable Member, do you have follow-up questions? Honourable Professor Bozoli, Mr. Chief.
It's more comment than a question. It's interesting that the Council for Higher Education is interested in the use of retired people and actually thinks it's quite a good idea. When only this past week, Minister Nzimande said, university staff are too old, too white, and too male, which goes right against in fact, earlier statements that he made, which said that universities should, in fact, make greater use of retirees and raise the retirement age. What's your comment on that? Thank you.
That's a rough one. that's very political. Commenting on Minister Nzimande's statement that academic staff are too old, too white, and too male, but at the same time, some years back, having said that we ought to raise the retirement age, and there's an apparent contradiction there.
Underlying statement there is actually talking about transformation. So if you can look at it from that angle.
Okay.
What are we saying about transformation? Are we making progress? And where there's a delay in transformation, are you able to assist in ensuring that this is fast track? Because remember, we now have been in existence for 21 years, and everybody's saying 21 years down the line,
okay, I'm not going to say very much more. I'm going to hand over to the board member. Other than to say that I think it's really important that the department has this program about staffing the universities. And in order to get new people in, you need to have all the mentors, and that's part of the program. And I think that that's a really good way to go. But apart from that, I'm going to hand over to my chair.
With your permission and very briefly, it's not a contradiction. Many universities have changed retirement age from 60 to 65. Other universities have also considered keeping on those that are beyond 65 as long as they are productive, because you don't want to keep somebody who is just sitting there and not performing. So that's the one thing. The second is that for the sustainability of our university system, we must bring in new blood. And that new blood must also begin to reflect the society which we find ourselves in. And so part of the transformation of the higher education system is also about who is producing new knowledge, who is teaching our students, and making sure that we don't just merely rely on people who, regrettably given life, will unfortunately pass on over time. You've got to bring in that. So there isn't really a contradiction. It's about making sure that those that are productive continue to be productive, support the development of the next generation. You'd have noticed, Chairperson, that one of the issues that we did put on the table is about the academe. Our work around why is it that young people are not wanting to become the next professors? Why is it that they want to go and work? Sometimes it's about money, but there are other issues as well that entice people to become those people who are the producers of new knowledge. So that's part of what we are going to do, but it's a bigger issue that I think as society as a whole we will need to reflect on, and I'm sure the ministers are doing the same.
I think that the questions are really important questions, and I want to just state that, you know, the CHE is at a very opportune moment, you know, given its life cycle, and that we would vigorously, and I want to assure members of the committee, that we would vigorously be taking up the alignment of what is happening in institutions with the National Development Plan. Because we do see that the kind of work that we have to do on the ground is to enhance productivity and the quality of life of the South African nation. So I just want to say that the issue around, you know, accreditation is really important, because it does, you know, ask of us to look at the overall purpose of accreditation towards what end. And that's what we are in the process of doing. And to locate, you know, the university sector as well as the post-school sector as engaged institutions in our society. so and how these institutions, you know, are at the cutting edge of innovation, science and technology. So I think I just want to support my colleagues there. The second point is that I think there has to be quite, you know, just a presence of caution. I think, like, even as a country, we've gone through a massification process. And I think, I mean,